You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As COVID-19 cases spread through the United States and Idaho, we want you to know that we are committed to keeping you updated and informed. You can always go to our website, boisestatepublicradio.edu, and we will make sure that we have all of the latest information up there for you. Now, as of 9:45 this morning, Idaho has 7 confirmed cases. 353 people have been tested. 76 people are currently being monitored. Now, since there is news coming in fast and furious, there also tends to be misinformation out there. There is also fear. Now, because of all of this, we wanted to make sure that we bring in the experts to answer as many of your questions as possible and to also separate fact from fiction. Joining us live in studio are Dr. David Pate, retired CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Jim Sousa, Chief Medical Officer for St. Luke's, and Dr. Stephen Nemerson, Chief Clinical Officer with St. Alphonsus. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
So first off, let's start with the number of cases that we have right now. So Dr. Pate, you met with the governor's COVID-19 task force yesterday. And now that we have 7 confirmed cases, what was the most important thing that you talked about so far within these meetings?
Well, we've talked about a lot of things. One is the shortage of testing. That remains a big concern. Second thing is the shortage of medical supplies, particularly when you see the pictures of the healthcare providers all dressed up in the gown and face shield and all that. We call that PPE or personal protective equipment, shortages of that, those two things. And then we spend a lot of time talking about our most vulnerable people that are in confined situations like nursing homes, prisons, psychiatric hospitals, those kinds of things.
And when we talk about the fact that we now have 7 confirmed cases from, and those new 2 came in this morning, as we said, because we were sitting at 5 and now we've got the 7. Are we at 7 and only 7 because we just have not tested enough? Or is it because, knock on wood, we're just lucky?
Well, there's some component of both.
Right.
So first of all, I know a lot of people have played this message. We have no idea how bad it is in Idaho because we're not testing. That's not exactly true because basically we do know the percentage of people that are likely to get severely ill, and we would know about the severely ill, and we're not seeing large numbers of severely ill. So we know there's not rampant spread of this across Idaho. Is there disease out there that we're not picking up? Assuredly, because frankly, a high percentage of people have a very mild illness and some people even asymptomatic. And so no doubt there's more cases of it out there, but these are the people being identified either because they're very sick or because they had identifiable risk factors.
I want to bring Dr. Sousa and Dr. Nemerson into the conversation. Both of you are boots on the ground within your hospital organizations. And as Dr. Pate said, you would know of those severe cases. I mean, talk to me about what you're seeing within your health system right now.
Thanks, Gemma. At St. Luke's, we're seeing a lot of rule out activity. We've got in one of our facilities a dozen or so patients under observation being tested. I think 8 in the Magic Valley, 4 in Boise, but so far they're largely continuing to come back negative. So a rule out COVID, which we've coined a ROC, is becoming an increasingly common reason for admission. Fortunately, most of those are returning negative.
Dr. Nemerson, what about St. Alphonsus?
And we're seeing very much the same thing. The unknown in that we have to prioritize testing right now for our patients that are inpatients in the hospital or patients who are at risk for suffering either significant illness should they acquire COVID or, God forbid, mortality, means that there's this large number of outpatients that we're seeing that we're not testing currently. And what we are seeing is an increased number of patients coming in with respiratory symptoms to our various centers for evaluation. And as those numbers increase, we all suspect that the incidence in the community, which we call community spread, is increasing. To what degree is difficult to know. And I hesitate to use abstract statistics if, as I'm sure you have among other experts, you talk about epidemiology, the numbers are all over the place. And so one patient that's been diagnosed with COVID by a confirmed test represents some number of dozens to maybe even hundreds of people who are in the community who are colonized, meaning they're asymptomatic, or who are bona fide infected, having very mild symptoms. And these are the people that we don't want to infect others.
I want to play a listener voicemail from Tony.
Yeah, my name is Tony. I live in Boise. My main question is, why are tests not being given out for the coronavirus? I have a friend and his girlfriend who just got back from the Philippines through South Korea flight connections. They were told to self-quarantine here in Boise for 10 days. But my friend started running a low-grade fever and called around, and there is nobody that will test him. And I'm concerned that the numbers in Idaho of coronavirus cases are just not even being reported.
So let's talk about that, because we are hearing stories like this. And this is where I think we need to separate fact from fiction, as I mentioned in the beginning. Are people being turned away from being tested, Dr. Pate?
Yes. There are some people who are coming and they're just worried and they want to be tested. We don't have that luxury because we don't have the supplies. And this is multifactorial. There's the laboratory capacity and capability to do testing, which is limited but growing. There is, on the provider side, the supply of testing materials to get samples to send to the lab. And then there's the third thing is to safely take those samples, because you will be exposed when you do that. You have to be in this protective gear. And we have shortages in all three categories. And so for right now, until those shortages are addressed, we have to be a lot more selective about who to treat. Now, this would be a very big deal if you had coronavirus, and if we only knew that, we could give you a treatment that would cure you or prevent you from giving it to somebody else or prevent a bad outcome, but we don't have a treatment right now. So, yes, we would all like more testing to be done, but right now it has to be prioritized to the highest risk people where it's really going to make a difference to us.
Oh. So when and if or how will we be able to test more people? Is there just a shortage of tests around the country?
Yes. So up until recently, for example, you take South Korea, they were doing more tests in a day than we have done since the outbreak in the United States. We're not doing the testing that volumes that a lot of others are doing. It is increasing. You know, but we've also been given promises that things were going to get better, and then they didn't. We were supposed to have about 4 million more tests last week. That didn't materialize. We are able to do more today than before. But there's some new technology come on, and certainly involving the commercial labs in this has helped increase testing, but that's still not the panacea. And now we've got some new technology that has just been FDA approved that actually would allow us to test more samples at a time. My question is, okay, going back to those three factors, if you can do, for example, these high throughput tests can do 1,000 tests in a run, are we going to have enough testing supplies to be able to give them 1,000 tests to run? And are we going to have enough PPE that we can protect healthcare workers to do those? So we just got a lot of pieces in the air.
So who should be getting tested right now?
So Gemma, I think there's a couple things to comment on that to provide reassurance, right? So someone who has cold-like symptoms and isn't able to obtain the test, that person can receive good, solid medical advice and isolate or what we call self-quarantine themselves to keep themselves from infecting their family. And so I think that reassurance is really critically important, and good communication between physicians and other providers and the patient and their family is something that we're augmenting. Now, in terms of who should be tested specifically, right now our priorities are those that are hospitalized with a condition that demonstrates symptoms consistent with coronavirus. And the reason for that is, one, we know in a predictable way how that disease will advance, and so we can be prepared within our hospitals to care for that patient. We also need to protect our healthcare workers so that they aren't exposed to the virus if that patient's carrying it. So that's a top priority. The second is patients who may not require hospitalization but are at risk if they were to acquire the virus of having an acute deterioration in their clinical condition and possibly ending up in the hospital. And those patients tend to be the elderly, and the numbers are all over the place. But for a working number that I think is good for a family member, if you're over 70, you're at a significantly elevated risk. If you're over 60, a slightly elevated risk. And below that, relatively flat in terms of population risk. So the elderly are at high risk, the immunocompromised are at high risk, and those who have what we call complex medical conditions, so multiple medical conditions that superimpose on one another, are also at increased risk. And when in doubt, because we've been encountering this at St. Alphonsus a lot, family members will call and say, I have a loved one who has these different medical conditions. Do I need to be worried if they were to get coronavirus? Ask your doctor.
And we should note, too, this just came out before we came on the air, that St. Luke's is beginning to open up drive-up testing and screening sites today at St. Luke's Wood River Valley and then St. Luke's Marini Hospitals. And then patients can be tested there from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. And then an additional site will be opening downtown Boise. And then more sites might be opening in Elmore, Fruitland, and the Magic Valley. Dr. Souza, why make that decision? And we've seen it. I mean, South Korea, as Dr. Pate said, Colorado's doing it. Why make that decision?
In part, it's to prevent the deluge that's hitting those emergency departments in those facilities. We'll be using similar screening criteria as to whether or not a test is actually performed. But the volume of patients crowding into EDs with symptoms wanting to be tested is quite large.
Well, yeah,
and could I just add, I want to reinforce a point that Dr. Souza just made. Even though you're seeing these drive-through testing sites open up and you are, that doesn't mean it's like a drive-through restaurant. You go and you order a hamburger,
No.
You get a hamburger. You still have to meet the criteria to get tested. So please don't go and get in those lines and go through all that process if you're well. If you are not having, you haven't had a known exposure, you haven't traveled to a high-risk country, don't go to those.
Well, and we should note, I want to talk before we take a quick break about flattening the curve. We have new terminology in this day and age, and flattening the curve is one of them. And the reason for that is, if I'm understanding this correctly, is that if we can spread out those cases, then people will have better outcomes. Because you still have businesses as usual at St. Alphonsus and St. Luke's.
Mm-hmm.
Women are still having babies.
Mm-hmm.
People still have cancer treatment. Can you go a little bit more in depth about that, doctors? Because I think it's critical that people understand why this is being implemented.
Sure. We run hospitals that are busy all the time and don't have a tremendous amount of surge capacity. And you've you've heard already that we need to focus on keeping our healthcare workers healthy. As we see more cases that unfortunately are on the severe end of the spectrum, require intensive care type of intervention, resource-intensive care. That combined with a workforce that could be out because they're sick, and we do not want our hospitals to be any place where someone would acquire this, right? Those two things combined, and we could be overwhelmed. So we're taking steps. I know St. Alphonsus is taking steps. We're actually collaborating and communicating together on our strategies to be prepared decant, if you will, the other work that we're doing so that we can handle a surge if it comes.
Sure. Gemma, you know, we are collaborating and working in coordination throughout the state. And on a normal day, our emergency departments throughout this state see thousands of patients. Now imagine if we had to triple that number of patients who require hospital care. And I'm not talking about high-level care. I'm just talking general hospital care to receive breathing treatments, fluids, and oral and other types of care, right? If we're trying to see triple the number in a given day, we just don't have the capacity to handle that. And we're surging to make that capacity available. And rest assured, we've been working at this for now several months in preparation. And nevertheless, when you talk about flattening the curve, if instead of tripling or worse the number of patients that have to be seen in a given day, we could make that a double. Obviously, it gives us more capacity to handle the volume that's coming. And then we're in this for the long haul, there's no question. And it gives us all of the resources that we're going to need to keep coming in and allow us to care for the patients.
My name is Melissa, and I live in Boise. My question is in regards to safety for healthcare workers. I've noticed in news reports from around the world, most of the healthcare workers are wearing significantly more personal protective equipment than what our own healthcare workers in the United States are wearing. Are our healthcare workers in the United States safe?
We are continuing our conversation with our panel of medical experts, Dr. David Pate, retired CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Stephen Nemerson, Chief Clinical Officer at St. Alphonsus, and Dr. Jim Souza, Chief Medical Officer for St. Luke's. That was a question from one of our listeners, and I would love for one of you to be able to answer her concerns.
I'll dive in. The safety of our healthcare workers, our employees, is of prime importance to all of us. I know that. We're adhering to all of the recommended standards relative to use of personal protective equipment. As Dr. Pate has pointed out, we're challenged with that supply chain, and I know everyone's working diligently to try to stay ahead of that. I think from the ground zero Wuhan where things started, we know that training on how to perfectly don and doff, let's take it off, the personal protective equipment is very important. And I think everybody around the country, including us, is engaged in bringing that training to our people, drilling and doing that well. As this thing progresses, we also need to be prepared to potentially even cohort patients and put like patients together with, clinically excellent teams.
One thing could I add,
yes.
Just to help keep our healthcare providers healthy, if you're going to go to your doctor's office or the emergency room or an urgent care center, call ahead, tell them that you're worried about this, because what we don't want you to do is come on into the waiting room and spread this around in the small chance that you do have it. So that gives us a chance to be prepared and treat you appropriately.
Dr. Nemerson.
Absolutely. And as Dr. Souza said, the protection of our healthcare providers is critically important because we are going to need them for the duration of this event. I'd like to note that the things you see on television are there because they create a dramatic picture. So a caregiver who's in a spacesuit is in that spacesuit most likely because they're caring for dozens of patients that are infected with coronavirus, and they're going to be contaminated, frankly, on their surfaces by all of the aggressive therapies that they're delivering. We know that we can gauge or stage the level of protective equipment that providers are using based on the treatments being given and the number of patients to which they're exposed. And so we all follow very strict guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control to protect our caregivers.
I want to go just quickly through some questions from listeners. So listener question online, does having had the flu shot and the pneumonia vaccine help lessen the impact of COVID-19?
No, not that we know of.
How many ICU beds do we have in Idaho? Do we know?
Oh, I can't tell you how many we have in Idaho. We think at the present time we've got enough beds, but we're thinking of how can we expand our capacity and actually create beds where maybe they don't exist today.
How many ventilators do we have in Idaho?
I also don't know how many ventilators we have. I do know that we've been saving old ventilators for a while, and one of my tasks actually today is to make certain that those are all operational and ready to go.
And Gemma, I think we're fortunately a little bit ahead of the game in Idaho. In terms of beds, ventilators, we've been at St. Alphonsus using an incident command structure to address these needs and plan our surge response. So we have the capability of expanding the number of beds significantly. We are already in conversation, and Dr. Pate may be able to touch on this, about accessing the national stockpile, which includes mechanical ventilators and other things that we're going to need. And we're also being very thoughtful about the fact that it's not just about machines and people. It's about medications and the equipment that's needed to deliver those medications. And so we're preparing stockpiles of that equipment as well to be able to be fitted to the machines and people that are needed.
For another listener, do we know how long the virus is viable on surfaces?
We don't. We know, though, it's at least days.
Right.
Does refrigeration or freezing kill the virus?
Don't know that yet. One big question is this virus temperature sensitive? Because one thing that's really important about that is as we get to the warmer months, will this disease activity go down like a lot of other cold and flu viruses do? We don't know the answer to that. We're less hopeful that that's going to be the case.
But I do want to make an important point for people who are at home. Is what does kill the virus. And the most important thing is good hand washing. 20 seconds, soap up first, and as my young daughters used to do, count to 20 or say twinkle, twinkle, little star, whatever works. And then alcohol gel, at least 70% concentration, which is becoming more scarce. We know that the lines in Costco have consume those quantities of alcohol gel, but that's one thing. And then I see on the counters in front of us, NPR is doing a phenomenal job disinfecting this place, and we've got Clorox wipes and Lysol wipes sitting right in front of my nose.
Want to continue asking listener questions. So one listener wants to know, is it possible for my pet to have the virus on its hair after being groomed by an infected groomer and then transferring the virus to a human? You're kind of all shaking your heads on
I'll
this
say,
one.
I'll say, Gemma, you win the award for the most amusing question of the day.
Sometimes we have to bring some levity into this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what it really comes down to is, how is this virus transmitted? How is it shared from one person to another? And it's thought to be most commonly by droplet, meaning somebody who has the virus has it in their respiratory system, their nose, their mouth, their lungs, and they cough or they sneeze, and the droplets that they sneeze out carry the virus. So that then contaminates their hand, which then contaminates what they touch. So in theory, I suppose, and I'll take this one for the group, I think if you petted a dog, maybe it would be more a Chihuahua than my dog, which is a Kizan. It's very furry. That droplet might be in a more less distributed area, and somebody could touch that contaminated dog and conceivably transmit it to their nose and mouth by rubbing their nose and mouth and get the disease. In reality, though, I would say love your dog. I think that's really an important thing. And wash your hands.
And wash your hands. Another question from a listener. What should you do if you are living with someone who is high risk?
I think you should adhere to the same good practices, really, we're advising everyone, to the degree that you can. Don't gather in large crowds. Use good hand hygiene. And then particularly in the home, double down on those things. Wipe off countertops and surfaces. And to the greatest extent possible, help that person who might be immunocompromised or at higher risk stay at home, and you be their conduit to the outside world for a while.
There is some information going around through social media about the virus starting in your throat and that it lasts there a couple of days before it goes into your lungs. So everyone is, I was seeing this on social media. So gargle, go get mouthwash or use vinegar. Fact or fiction? Or do we know?
I think we don't know for sure, but I'm largely going to say fiction on that. There'd be little evidence that in between gargles, for example, you're not continuing to aerosolize viral particles into the airstream where they're deposited deeper in the bronchial tree.
But all three of us are proponents of good oral hygiene.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
But you're right. That's probably not going to prevent it.
And then what about people who are asymptomatic? There was an interview just yesterday with Donovan Mitchell, a Utah Jazz player who has tested positive, was tested because he was exposed to someone, saying right on national television, I feel fine. I have no symptoms. If someone told me to play a 7-game run tonight, I could do it. So we know that's possible. But is that also why we are seeing this idea of this is why we need to not be in large groups right now?
Absolutely. And this is the thing that I'm most concerned about. We just had, St. Patrick's Day, and I heard the bars were very crowded and the restaurants were doing a wonderful business, not necessarily here in
Boise. We saw it in Chicago quite a bit.
We saw it in Chicago. And that was very disappointing to me, because there's a lot of other people who are like Donovan, who are out there, they're having good social interchange, and then they inadvertently cough in somebody's face. And that's exactly how the virus gets transmitted.
Another listener, I was originally planning to fly to Vermont in July. I canceled that ticket. I'm now wondering about my scheduled trips to the Wood River Valley in April and Eastern Oregon in June. In fact, is traveling at all, regardless of the distance, at all a good idea at this point?
You know, to answer that question, I think you have to consider a number of factors. What is the extent of community spread where you would be going? So, for example, there are some places I would definitely cross off your list. I don't think you need to be going to Seattle or New York City right now. If you're just talking about going in Idaho, we have rather low levels of concern. So, but of course, things that are not entirely clear to us, could this be transmitted on an airplane? Someone asked me about taking a trip where they were going to drive in the car. Well, that's very low risk. But it depends on where are you going, how are you getting there, and what are you going to do when you get there is going to affect your risk.
And we heard the president in a news conference the other day say, Well, some people say this, you know, we could be like this into July, August, September. Is that what we should be preparing for as a society?
I think we don't know. And I think that's why you heard the president give that kind of a range. I don't think we know.
We don't. And, you know, the great news, like you heard Dr. Nimmerson talking about, all this, the efforts that we do make to social distancing should help slow down the spread. The converse side is the more we slow it down, we preserve that we're vulnerable and we haven't established immunity. I don't think we're going to see the end of this virus. There are some scenarios where we might, but I don't think we're going to see the end of this until we develop a large amount of immunity. And that's going to mean we get the vaccine, and that's going to be next year. So I'm hoping the president is right, but I'm not counting on it.
We have about 2 minutes left. I would like to know from each of you the number one piece of information that you would like the general public to know. I'll start with you, Dr. Souza.
Social distancing. I think, Gemma, unfortunately, we only need to look to Italy, Seattle, some of the activity happening on the coasts to know, what could be coming if we don't use the knowledge we have now to take a different course of action. You know, I think the things that are being enacted now in Seattle, 2 months after their first case, I'm happy to see us enacting a lot of those things now, and that's good news for Idaho.
Dr. Nemerson?
Two things. Wash your hands and don't go to work sick.
And Dr. Pate?
One thing that recently I've been spending a lot of time being concerned about is when we self-isolate somebody because they have symptoms and we can't be sure that they don't have COVID, we've taken a pretty lax position relative to family members, and we let them go out and do stuff. I'm worried. We used to think that the sicker you were, the more likely you were to transmit that. There's some reasons to believe that may not be true. I think we need, if somebody's being isolated at home because they might have this and you don't have the testing results yet, everybody at home needs to act like you have it.
I want to thank all of you for coming in today. Such critical conversations to be having right now, and to alleviate some of the fear and talk about the facts. Our panel of experts today, Dr. Jim Souza, who is with St. Luke's, Dr. Stephen Nemerson with St. Alphonsus, and Dr. David Pate on the Coronavirus Task Force for the state of Idaho. I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters.